Okay, now for all those thorny ethical questions about Syria. Whenever tough questions arise, we call in the ethics professors to clear the air or maybe even muddy it up even more, right? They are Wayne Vaught. He's the dean of the UMKC College of Arts and Sciences. He's also a professor of philosophy, medicine, and bioethics. And Wayne, always good to have you.
Welcome good to be back here. Thanks for having me, Steve.
Clancy Martin's also here. He's a professor and chair of the Department of Philosophy at UMKC. Clancy, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having us, Steve. Good morning.
So the Syrian situation raises all kinds of questions. Let's begin with this one, gentlemen. Given that chemical weapons are alleged to be involved here, you know, is the president obligated to act, Wayne, from an ethical standpoint, even if Congress turns him down?
I think that there can be a moral obligation that citizens have to, when they have an opportunity and the means to intervene when there is a harm that's a recognizable harm in which somebody can do something about. The difficulty with this is that you have a president who's going to be committing troops, committing public resources, committing a lot of public capital into an issue, and I think that it is critical that the public, since this is a utilization of public resources, has a say in this and is given an opportunity to effectively know what's going on and to participate in that discussion.
So you're saying you don't think he should proceed unless he has some type of authorization from the Congress of the United States?
You know, the difficulty is knowing the exact facts and the information and the intelligence that the president has to deal with this. I mean, the president is empowered to make certain types of decisions, and the public, what we have in terms of what the media has released to us, may not necessarily be all the facts that are available. And so I think in certain circumstances, the president would be empowered to act and ought to act based on a moral imperative to intervene in a way that was necessary to prevent, especially if it was an egregious harm being done to a large population of people, as we're sort of seeing here. However, if the information is such that there's some uncertainty, and we're certainly seeing with Great Britain sort of deciding, well, okay, well, we're going to pull back on this. I think when you get major leaders of world organizations should have some dialogue, and there should be some synergy there. And I do get very worried when you have sort of a unilateral approach. Someone is going to jump in and try to solve a problem without engaging at least world leaders in this discussion. So I would be very reserved to say that there is such a compelling moral imperative that the president ought to act without the support of the American people.
You know, Clancy Martin, you know, given the fact what Wayne just said, that there is not a broad consensus among other nations of the world here, does that only put more pressure on this idea that a president, any president for that matter, needs to have congressional backing before he would shoot missiles into Syria?
Well, I think it does put more pressure on the president to demonstrate that he has the support of the nation which is providing him with these resources, as Wayne points out, before making those kinds of commitments. I mean, there is the relevant factor that we, of course, do not have all the intelligence that the president has, and the president does have these kinds of powers in extraordinary circumstances. And there are many instances, even in our very recent history, when terrible moral atrocities could have been prevented if a president had acted more swiftly and decisively. And that there are two sides to this issue that we need to think about.
We've passed on some of these instances even in recent years, going back to President Clinton going forward, and now this is a different situation.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Clinton expressed regret about some of the decisions that he made when he felt like he acted too slowly or didn't act at all when certain kinds of international atrocities were taking place. As I say, there are two sides to the equation. We need to think about them both. The first is what kind of empowerment does the president – do we feel that the president of our country ought to have before we allow him to commit troops and treasure to a foreign engagement of some kind? And then the other is, what would count as sufficiently urgent grounds for us to make such an engagement? Because given that we as a public don't have access to all of this information. We have to raise the question, well, where do we set the bar at which we will say, no, this we will no longer allow to take place?
Well, this is really a tricky proposition the two of you are talking about, though, here. If we're agreeing to this notion that the American people, we don't have all the information a president does, then it's so much more difficult for us to really render a proper judgment as to how the president should proceed then, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And unfortunately, as we know, there's only so much information in these situations of kind of national, international crisis. There's only so much information we can be provided because of security concerns, because mm-hmm. because of martial, I guess we should say, concerns. If we think of the example, to take something from a little further in the past, if we think of the example of Hitler and the kinds of coalition building that were being attempted while Hitler was invading Poland, while Hitler was making his protests of peace, and we now look back on history and say, well, an awful lot of very, very unfortunate, you know, moral catastrophes could have been prevented mm-hmm. if there hadn't been so much deliberation. So there may be at times an excess of deliberation.
And maybe in this case, you know, with the president sort of stopping his plans to get the authorization from Congress and get them engaged here, mm-hmm. it's going to stretch this process out for a ways.
And one thing we may want to think about in these circumstances is I suppose at some level this is a subjective thing, but it is part of having a leader and choosing a leader is, do we consider our leader to be a rash person or a deliberative person?
Yeah.
Do we look at the history of this leader's decisions and say he or she has a tendency to act preemptively, mm-hmm. irresponsibly, irrationally? Or do we say that this person has a history of tending to act with deliberation, with caution, yeah. with prudence? In the case of our current president, I would say, if anything, the guy has a strong track record of acting on of erring on the side of prudence, mm-hmm. on erring on the side of caution. So when suddenly he's championing something that sounds a little bit risky, one has a tendency to give him maybe a little more credit than we might give some of our other leaders.
Let me get our listeners involved here. And the question on the table is here, what moral obligation does the president have to get the consent of Congress before he would take such a dramatic step as shooting missiles into Syria? What do you think? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Our email address, UpToDate@kcur.org. You can also tweet us @KCURUpToDate. We're visiting with our ethics professors, Wayne Vaught and Clancy Martin. I guess, Wayne, we could also ask the question the other way, too. You know, given that chemical weapons are involved here, you know, isn't Congress obligated morally to give its consent for an attack against Syria, given these circumstances?
Mm-hmm. One of the issues that we have to talk about, we don't have a lot of time to get into the details about it, but it would certainly be with just war theory and the issues
yes.
about when it's appropriate to engage in an armed conflict, or when it's – and then when you're engaged in the armed conflict, what are the ethics of battle? And there are some. I mean, you don't just do – you know, you don't just shoot missiles in because you have them and that's the way you think that you can solve the conflict. We would need to know, and I would need to know a whole lot more details about what diplomatic approaches have been accomplished here. What are the possibilities of creating alliances? How many damaging and potentially life-threatening interventions are available? And certainly given what we've seen in the media about the use of the chemical weapons, and if these were continuing to be used and we knew that there was significant loss of life potential, I think you could argue that there's a ethically justified intervention at sacrificing certain lives if you know that that's going to prevent the harm or injury to someone
yeah.
else. And so you could say that there is a moral imperative to do so when you are in a position to have the power to do it. But again, this I think still requires a type of alliances and relationships that you're just not sort of acting on your own, as if, you know, we have sort of designated ourselves as the world guardians or the world cops or world police on this matter.
You know, we are at an interesting juncture here, because the phrase that has us all up in arms, as it should, is chemical weapons.
Correct.
You know, what if the Syrian government was simply, not to be too crass here, but simply mowing down its own citizens with machine gun fire? You know, there is this notion, and the president talked about it yesterday, the idea that, you know, the line has been crossed. This is a line that many world leaders have drawn mm-hmm. in the past, which is use of chemical weapons. But why are chemical weapons the ones that would cause us to go in and perhaps intervene here, as opposed to some other kind of atrocity in the making, like mowing people down with machine guns day after day, that kind of thing, Clancy?
Yeah, or machetes, as has very commonly been the case in Africa.
Yes,
exactly.
Absolutely.
Why are chemical weapons so much worse than machetes? I mean, I do think that this is part of why Wayne's point about coalition building and proper due diligence is crucial here, because there are certain sorts of weapons that seem to kind of produce an immediate and irrational hysteria.
Right.
One of those is chemical weapons. Another, of course, are nuclear weapons. You know,
of course.
And
for good reason.
Right. Well, in some sense, definitely, for good reason.
A lot of particularly.
Yeah. And because a bullet at the end of the day kills one person, whereas a chemical weapon, we have a hard time predicting how many people it's going to kill. We know that it's probably going to kill much more indiscriminately than a bullet will.
Yeah.
But so I think that's one of the reasons that chemical weapons frighten us and produce this kind of hysteria. But your point is a morally relevant one. At the end of the day, what we should be talking about is the question of a country, whether or not a country is victimizing its citizenry, whether its victimization of its citizenry is calling into question its ability to be a government at all, mm-hmm. or whether they've just become a bunch of bandits. And if they are no longer really governing their citizenry and they've become a bunch of bandits, then it does look like, according to any kind of rules of reasonable engagement, there can be a justified intervention in order to protect those innocents, regardless of whether it is machetes or machine guns or chemical weapons or a nuclear device. So I do think there's a little bit of hysteria in the political rhetoric when we say, okay, now because it's chemical weapons, this is a particular line in the sand.
We're visiting with our ethics professors. The question on the table here: what kind of moral obligation does the president have to get Congress's consent before sending missiles into Syria and attacking there? That's the question on the table. 816-235-2888. Our email address, UpToDate@kcur.org, and you can also tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. And you know, gentlemen, like always, these questions, the answers sometimes are a lot more difficult to come up with than we tend to think sometimes. Mm-hmm. Let's go back to some phone calls here. David from Independence. David, you're on UpToDate. Good morning.
Well, what I'd like to see is a very specific objective before we commit any kind of resources to it. It just seems like it's been a protracted system in the last 30 years here now that we don't have any set goals to, you know, whether it's a peace treaty or what. We just go in and make a muck of it and then walk out.
And David, we say you want a specific objective. You're looking for what exactly?
Well, Sudan, they had a long conflict there. They now have two countries. To me, that might be, what they need to do is set up different countries over there where they're self-governing bodies instead of, one country that's, fighting within itself. It's a hard, hard thing to look at, but that may be what we have to do is sit down with, all the parties involved and say, you can't do this at all anymore. It's bad for everybody.
Right.
What we'd like to sit down and do is set up, some give and take. You're going to get this, you're going to get that, and you're going to govern yourself.
All right. David, I appreciate the phone call. Thank you.
All right.
Gabby writes us this at UpToDate at KCUR.org. She writes, public opinion should not govern stopping another Holocaust. She mentions Hitler in her post as well. Deborah from Overland Park. Deborah, you're on UpToDate. Good morning.
Good morning. I agree with your one guest that our president has erred on the side of prudence for too long. The Syrian government, the Assad regime, knows exactly what we're going to do, when we're going to do it, how long we're committed to do it. They're ready for us. So by all this dawdling that we've done, not only does the United States have egg on their face and no credibility in the international community, we've drawn a red line in the sand over a year ago, and there have been at least 14 episodes of these chemical weapons being used, and we've done nothing. And now when there were over 1,000 people, we're starting to talk about maybe doing something. And I think the whole thing is absurd. Our president should have acted immediately when he drew the red line in the sand.
All right. Deborah, thank you very much. You know, and there is this question that lingers, too, whenever these debates come up, gentlemen, this idea that, you know, it always seems to fall back on the United States to be the country that sort of takes the bulk of the responsibility here in one form or another. And you wonder about the fairness of that, you know.
Well, and it's related to a couple of points made by the callers and a point that, Wayne has been hammering away on as well. Two things. First of all, in terms of our historical track record, it doesn't look as though we're very good at it, the job of being the world's globocop, so to speak. I mean, because we might be good sometimes at stopping these things from happening, but we're very bad at in the kinds of aftermaths that we leave behind. We tend to create bigger – we leave behind bigger messes very often when we go in and try to solve the problem. So that's the first thing. It doesn't look like we're very good at it. The second thing is and this was part of, I think, Wayne's and David, the earlier caller's point. We're talking about this as though we're operating in some kind of international vacuum, but we're not. I mean, when we go into Syria, it's not just Syria that is going to react to this attack. There are a whole host of nations that are allied to Syria in one way or another, and most of them are not presently friends of the United States, and a lot of them have very strong ideological positions against the United States, and some of them are nations which we have recently attacked in the past. So all of these things I'm perhaps sorry to say, and against the previous caller, because I sympathize with her worries about dawdling in morally urgent circumstances, but they do speak in favor of caution because we are awfully good at making bad situations worse.
Back to some phone calls here. Alex from Overland Park. Alex, you're on UpToDate. Good morning.
Good morning. I guess the first thing is I would quibble with the question. I don't know that the president has a moral authority to seek Congress's approval. It's probably more of a constitutional or political obligation to seek their approval. And my other problem is that I don't think America has much credibility when it comes to weapons of mass destruction. We're the only country that's ever used nukes.
Mm-hmm. And that's a fair point, isn't it? Yeah. Wayne?
No, I think it's right. We do need to be careful. And going back to the previous caller, I think that we've talked about Nazi Germany, and I think the point about having an end game, having an end result, having a target that you look for is exactly the lesson that we were supposed to have learned after World War I. So when we went in, we destroyed Germany. We took off, pretty much left them in disarray, and we had a rise out of that disarray, what we then had to confront during World War II. And so if we were to take that approach again, you go in, you strike, and then you leave, and you have no real plan for what's the outcome supposed to be, what's the objective supposed to be, you have no idea what's going to come out of this. And I think that's sort of what Clancy said. We sometimes do a really good job of making a bad situation worse. And unless there are those types of conversations that are at place and we know exactly what we're doing, yes, this is a horrific situation. And are we now going to throw gasoline, as it were, on this situation and make it that much worse for everybody?
You know, one other lingering question, and both of you have touched on this, and I'll be just really brief here. There is this some question about the validity of the evidence on the table here. And what do we know? What do we not know? And I can't say I'm completely up to speed on exactly what both of those things are. But that's a question here. We've been down this road before, haven't we, Clancy?
Yeah, that's the thing, is we've been down this road before and recently down this road, and we were misled by people who seem to have very sincere intentions. I mean, there's this famous cover of The Economist magazine with George W. Bush and Tony Blair arm in arm, and it read, "Sincere Deceivers." And what they meant by sincere deceivers is those fellows thought that they were doing the right thing. They thought they had good intelligence, but they had lied to themselves before they lied to everybody else. Now, we hope that President Obama isn't in the same situation here. Certainly, he's operating on the basis of what has actually happened, as far as we can tell, rather than some imaginary smoking gun. The previous caller makes a good point that our record when it comes to responding to weapons of mass destruction is not exemplary.
Okay. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our very good conversation with our ethics professors. We'll talk about Cuba and ask the question, how long is too long to hold a grudge? We'll also talk about this lingering question about the 2014 Winter Olympics in Russia. Should we boycott those games or not? And coming up later on this hour, Brian McTavish with your weekend to-do list. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. This hour, we're wrestling with a whole host of tough ethical questions with our ethics professors. They are Dean Wayne Vaught from UMKC and Clancy Martin, also of UMKC, chair of the philosophy department. Clancy, you just got back from a trip to Cuba. What did you pick up there about U.S. policy when it comes to Cuba and whether this ongoing U.S. embargo is still a good idea or not?
Well, the first thing I'll say is that Cubans are, first they ask you if you're French.
they're not used to seeing many Americans.
No, they're not used to seeing many Americans. When they find out that you're American or that you're from America, I'm Canadian, but I've spent all my adult life in America. They're delighted to be speaking to Americans, and the first thing they always say is, America and Cuba, the governments don't get along, but the people do. And then they all immediately talk about family members they have in America and people who've been friends of theirs who've lived in America and have come back to Cuba, which people do. As far as the people of Cuba are concerned, I didn't meet a single person who wasn't extremely pro-America and anti-embargo. Not one person.
They were pro-America.
Pro-America. And I was there, for a magazine. I was also writing a book and there as part of a university conference. But I was partially there as a journalist. So I was talking to a lot of different people. And everybody I met was pro-America. And was not surprised to hear that in my experience, Americans felt like the average American, I would always say, was probably sort of pro-Cuba. I mean, that we didn't view Cuba in the way that we did 20 years ago, that most Americans I know would like to visit Cuba if they could, would be interested to visit Cuba. Another interesting thing I noticed was I was taking a bus from Havana down to southern Cuba, and I got on this bus. The bus was nicer than any airplane I've ever been on in the United States. It had a video screen in the back of every seat, so you could, choose and, the movie you wanted to watch or whatever. It was air conditioned. It was a beautiful bus, much, much nicer. Wow. I often take the bus up to Iowa City where my wife is a graduate student.
And that's a whole different deal.
Very, very different experience than the bus in Cuba, let me tell you. And the most delightful thing about the movie selections on the bus was you could choose between two languages, Spanish and Chinese.
Oh.
And you look at the bus and the manufacturer of the bus was Chinese, and everywhere I went where I noticed signs of of affluence, signs of progress. There was, in every instance, it was a Chinese manufacturer, it was a Chinese contribution. And what I took away from this, one more thing I'd like to add, what I took away from this was that if America doesn't act in terms of seeing the wonderful resources of this incredibly beautiful country of Cuba, other countries will, and in fact already are. So I think the ending the embargo is long overdue. Now, Raul Castro, who, as you know, is the younger brother of Fidel and was one of the leaders in the revolution. I mean, he was, along with Che Guevara. Che Guevara, yeah, and Raul were Fidel's right and left-hand men. Raul is still very much, well, he describes himself as a socialist, not as a communist. But he has, as any Cuban will tell you, he has a lot of grudges against, personal grudges against the United States. So it isn't just that, my perception going over there was that Cuba would be welcoming to America ending the embargo and that it was really an American issue. But that's not true. Huh. I mean, the Cuban government, as I was told, is still highly suspicious and has some grudges against the American government.
Well, I guess the question, Wayne, it sort of comes down to how long is too long to hold a grudge? I mean, this has been going on now for one half of a century,
right,
almost
right.
Exactly. That's a long time.
Yeah, I think the issue of holding grudges is probably inappropriate because typically that means you're closing off information and you're not looking at the current situation and what's going on and you're sort of –
which may be the case here.
I think absolutely right. And so probably holding a grudge past a couple months is probably too long. And then you really need to start getting on with things and, mm-hmm. and figuring out what's really in the best interest of the people involved here. And not doing things simply out of certain way past ideologies that are actually harmful to all the major people who are involved.
I guess the question on the table for our listeners, is it time to end the embargo with Cuba? What do you think? How long is too long to hold a grudge? And also, if you want to chime in on our final topic today, this idea of whether we should boycott the 2014 Winter Olympic Games or not in Russia because of that nation's policy towards gays, I'd be interested in those comments too. 816-235-2888 and our email address here, updatedate@kcur.org. I guess one ethical question, Clancy, is does your government have a right to tell you where you can go and where you can't go, which is still obviously in effect here when it comes to Cuba?
Well, I mean, certainly your government has the power to tell you where you can go and,
yes,
and can't go. Whether or not it ought to have that power, whether or not it ought to have that right, is something that this nation was founded on, and we founded this nation on the notion that no, the government ought not to have that power to tell you where you can and cannot go. So I think it is I think that the embargo will come to an end. Although I spoke with a bartender who, interestingly, bartenders and waiters and cooks in Cuba make more than doctors do, make more than dentists do, make more than professors do.
Yeah.
This fellow had been a professor before he became a bartender, and he was a bartender and
say?
A cook. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Where are we
yeah.
all going here?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. He'd been a professor of Spanish literature at the university, but. We were having a conversation about it, and I said, well, what, you know, I said, surely Raul's going to change this, isn't he? And he said, well, me and my friends from the university, we get together once a year to have a weekend where we talk about this. And every weekend, every year, we say, 5 more years. And we've been saying that for 7 years now, and not a single thing has changed. And he said, so I've given up hope of it changing.
Let's move on to Russia here, gentlemen. Just a few minutes we have left. This question of whether the U.S. and other countries should boycott next year's games in Russia because of that country's policy, very anti-gay policy that's in effect there. There's a lot to weigh here. And one of those things, of course, always comes down to, do you punish the athletes as well, if you do boycott, who have worked so hard to compete at such a high level, Wayne, how are you sorting this set of questions out?
Yeah, I think it is probably an unfair punishment to the athletes, particularly homosexual athletes who may very much want to participate. One of the questions I think in boycotts like this is always, how effective really is this? Is this more of a political statement than actually that's something that's going to be effective at accomplishing results? And when you think about sports and how sports have been used around the world in ways that have brought people together and resolved major conflicts in South Africa, certainly. Even in the United States with race relations, it wasn't because of the lack of integrating and the lack of playing sports. It was because those sports were forced on people in certain situations. You know, the Kentucky Western Texas game is an example of how that impacted race relations. And it's sports that really has, I think, people belittle the significance that sports can play in these issues. And so I'm not so sure that boycotting as opposed to integrating and enforcing these issues. I mean, we saw it again with race relations during the World War II era. I mean, with Germany. So,
I mean, just leading by example.
I think so.
Get to know.
I think so. I don't think just saying, "Hey, we're not coming over and playing these games," is the most effective way to deal with this response. Now, that doesn't mean that I think that it's problematic or that we shouldn't try to aggressively promote equal rights for all people, regardless of their race or sexual orientation. We should be doing that. I just don't know that boycotting games is the most effective approach to doing that.
20 seconds, Clancy. That's all I got.
Well, I do think that wherever we encounter, as Wayne just said, human rights violations, we should make strong statements about those human rights violations. And I think in this case, the athletes who are speaking out are doing a great job of that. But yes, complete boycotts may be counterproductive.
I want to thank Wayne Vaught and Clancy Martin, both from UMKC. They are our ethics professors. Gentlemen, thanks so much.